Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where we're broadcasting from. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the internet or on our podcast on 98.9 FM, welcome to you as well. So good morning, Karen. Karen Durrenty is my co-host until tomorrow when
yes,
Tiger's
indeed.
Back.
Tiger is back. How's your day been so far?
Oh, it's been all right.
Yeah.
Good. It's not even Wednesday yet.
I know. Did you watch last night's Four Corners?
I didn't. I don't have a TV at my house at the moment.
Okay, right. Oh, no, look, it was a really interesting story about 7-Eleven and their workplace practices where basically people were being paid under the award wage. I mean, that's certainly something that we're familiar with, at least in Aboriginal history. It just seemed really... I just couldn't believe it that sort of stuff was happening in Australia.
Yeah, it's really disgraceful. Good on Four Corners for opening it up, though, because everyone's got contact with, 7-Eleven at one point in their life.
And I was expecting sort of my news feed on Facebook would be people sort of saying, I'm not going to go buy milk or bread from 7-Eleven ever again until they, clean up their backyard and their practices and stuff like that. But it just wasn't
I don't think Australians genuinely care because it's, the othering. I mean, it's not our workers. They sort of see it as, I think. But, that's a conversation.
It's those brown people. We really don't care about them.
I think that's a bit part of it, If it was white fellas,
it's really
it'd be
sad.
A bit different.
Yeah.
It is
sad,
yeah. But our guest this morning is a Ngunnawal academic. First time on the program, I think, Darren Parker at the University of Melbourne. How are you this morning, Darren?
Oh, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Karen.
Good to have you here. Yeah, and we're all across the country, so I don't know if we broadcast into Melbourne, do we, Karen? Or
we get internet down here.
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't know that.
No, we get the internet down here now.
Okay, running water too.
Everyone's still getting used to it.
First of all, what's your mob and where's your country?
Ngunnawal. So it sits across what's now the ACT and New South Wales.
Yeah, so Canberra boy. Exactly. Canberra raised?
Canberra is pretty much the central focal point. Ironic that, I've had an interest in law and politics where the national parliament's situated on my land.
Yep. And, Canberra has this hidden history because I spent a long time, 7 years in Canberra, and it's actually got this really hidden black history, and you can drive around the suburbs and there's actually areas of real cultural significance that you wouldn't even know about. Like I went and saw an ochre mine in the middle of Gungahlin, and I was just amazed at that, that they just don't respect Ngunnawal history or anything, and the cultural heritage is even more, vulnerable in the nation's heartland than the nation's capital.
It's pretty much our cultural heritage is under threat pretty much from housing expansion, residential developments.
Yeah, and it's...
Because as you say, it's right there.
Yeah, and it's ironic that you've got Tony Abbott in Canberra talking about being a Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs and at the same time no one is talking about this really important heritage in their own backyard.
Very true, very true.
Now, Darren, what's your name? You're a legal academic now, but you started off your professional career as a chef.
I was a chef, yes. I was a chef for 15 years. It was to get out of... I grew up in Cabramatta, funnily enough. As a child of divorce and, it wasn't the greatest family situation, I'll be honest. And I saw becoming a chef and cooking as a way of, not to put too fine an edge on it, escaping that somewhat. So I did an apprenticeship in a couple of places in Sydney and then basically I grabbed a passport and travelled.
Right.
And worked around the world, met absolutely enormous bunch of crew, particularly Indigenous folks from all over the world. And, obviously, great people, great cultures and fantastic foods.
I can imagine. So somewhere along the line, you've decided to become a lawyer, but you specifically specialise in public law. Is there a reason for that?
Because as I said, growing up in a what was actually quite a violent family household from my father, a white Australian and with Irish heritage, suffered a lot of, there's no other way to say it, a lot of racism, direct racism, psychological, emotional and physical abuse in that way. And when a number of times when obviously we'd call the police and the police would come out, the police actually sort of compounded many of the problems almost every single time they were called to the house. You know, they came with a very relaxed attitude. They came with almost, a contemptuous attitude towards us because we were just, black fellas. It was just a domestic, pretty sort of blunt attitudes towards us. And, whether I sort of, acknowledged it at the time, I certainly acknowledge it now with the benefit of hindsight looking back to it, is it was quite formative for me in looking at the absolute superstructure of a legal system.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what sort of pointed me towards looking at public law, because that's essentially the person, the individual, vis-a-vis the state. And that's the way I was formulated through those experiences, because I saw the police as the embodiment of the state. And I took it from there.
It's really important to look at that whole superstructure, isn't it? Because I feel like when we do report on justice issues and really outrageous, stories, a 12-year-old kid getting locked up over buying a Freddo frog and stealing a Freddo frog
and
everything that happens up in the territory.
Or a 10-year-old kid being detained, in a police watch house in Mount Isa as well. So
people are outraged, but when you actually look at the whole way the Australian legal system is set up, it's actually not that surprising that we would have outcomes like that, particularly affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, is it?
No, it's for anyone that's sort of researched or, even just experienced these, type of situations, it's self-evident. It's as plain as the nose on your face, where, and it's unfortunate. It's not unfortunate. It's bloody, frustrating as all hell when you see in the, mainstream media the absolute lack of reportage in regards to these issues and these instances that occur time and time again. It's quite frustrating in that sense.
Darren and Amy, just for the benefit of people, when you're talking about the superstructure, are you talking basically going back to the founding document of this nation?
I certainly am. Mm. In many ways, it was one of the reasons why I did move into public law with my research, my academic research, and also my teaching, is because the formative political and legal document of Australia, the Constitution, is a document that's predicated on our people's exclusion.
Yeah. And I just wanted to tell our listeners, you wrote a really important piece. I think it was probably one of the best analysis piece around sort of the current constitutional debate for Crokey, which is an online publication run by a prominent health journalist, Melissa Sweet. And you actually go through a lot of these issues, but you particularly point to whether it is actually possible to decolonise the legal system so that we can have justice for our peoples. And you started out with a history of the Constitution, and I feel like when you were talking about the media, we're not actually talking about the Constitution in the way that it was actually formed, because it was never about people, as you talk about in your article. It was completely about sort of the
colonies coming together
and the priorities of white landowning males, as you say. So it's never been about our people.
Many people can sort of, you know, push back on this point. And when I say many people, I mean mainstream media for the most part, or, you know, ill-informed white Australians. And, you know, I won't pull any punches. You get a lot of pushback from when you say that because, you know, it's like, that was then, this is now. Well, no, it has not changed a great deal. And when we talk about the origins of a particular document, such as the Constitution, it has a legacy. It has a knock-on effect. You know, those ripples are still being felt to this day. And, you know, to disprove those sort of naysayers in that regard, I mean, I only have to point people towards, like, the 1890 constitutional conventions, you know, that occurred over a number of years in both, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and how they were only attended by white landholding males. It's a matter of the historical record that it's an, you know, irrefutable fact in that regard.
Well, do you think the current focus on constitutional reform is the right focus? I mean, a big part of the opposition to sort of recognise our mob in the Constitution is the fact that it isn't our Constitution. I mean, it's always been historically a racist document.
No. Well, it's a great question, Amy. And as sort of Karen was alluding to just before, you know, it's a document that was predicated upon the marriage of the former colonies for purposes of trade and commerce and also purposes of racial exclusion, more so than it ever could be construed as a people's constitution. And even if it was a people's constitution, by, you know, clear, unequivocal fact, at that very time, us mob were not considered peoples. So, therefore, we were excluded in a very real sense, you know. And it was over those, you know, the course of those two conventions through the 1890s, where there was no inclusion of women, no black fellows, no ethnic communities, only stocked with those white landowning males. Now, its racist origins are well known in that sense, but then they went on to further embody those origins and those, you know, ideological thoughts into the actual ink on the Constitution. You know, it's silent about Indigenous peoples prior to occupation, whereas these provisions that they're so focused on removing, these so-called racist provisions, such as Section 25 and 127, even Section 51.26, are based upon Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' exclusion and discrimination. Yeah. Now, everyone's sort of at the moment talking about we need to get racism out of the Constitution, and I totally agree, we do. But at the same time, a bit of legal and, you know, constitutional awareness would also go well in those thoughts, because while Section 25 allows for a federal government to exclude certain races from not being counted in the votes of elections, it's actually never been used.
Yeah.
And it's what we call in law a dead letter.
Yeah.
Now, sure, that can and should be removed to a great extent, but it's actually never been removed. Now, if we remove that, us mob, and we vote yes to remove that, all good and well, but does that benefit us on the ground?
Going through to the 1967 referendum and just taking up a lot of these issues, I mean, the 1967 referendum is always painted as this positive for our people, but it allowed governments to legislate for us and also to our detriment. So when you talk about, you know, sort of popular movements to remove racism from the Constitution, to sort of dismantle a lot of this discrimination, often it has bad flow-on effects to people on the ground.
And you're definitely right about that. See, pre-1967, Section 5126 actually had a section or a sentence in it which said, you know, the Commonwealth government could make laws for the peoples of any race except Aboriginal peoples. And that was then, you know, voted upon in the 1967 referendum, and it was removed, which then brought us into the purview of the federal government, meaning that they could then make laws for us, or about us, I should say.
And we've seen in history, I mean, you talk about what can flow on from the Constitution sort of keeping these racist elements, and it's that overt discrimination. It's things like, you know, the Hindmarsh Bridge case and also the anti-intervention, which is probably the most prominent case.
Well, exactly. And you've hit, you know, both of the major issues that come up or arisen since our so-called inclusion, you know, from 1967. And it's, you know, the Cartinieri case or the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case, as well as the implementation of the Northern Territory intervention. Because once we were, you know, included in Section 5126 post 1967, it was therefore legally allowable for the federal government to make laws, you know, regarding Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. In Cartinieri, that was actually, you know, a long drawn out saga. I'm sure yourself, Karen, and many of the listeners already know about the, you know, arduous detail of that. But the shorter version of what occurred was that the federal government, the Howard government, it was at the time, basically suspended the Racial Discrimination Act and allowed for the construction of a bridge to the detriment of the, you know, mob down in South Australia and to destroy their cultural heritage. They challenged that. It got to the High Court and it was basically, you know, it was a bit of a split decision. Two justices decided it could be used detrimentally. Two decided that it couldn't, and it was to be, laws were to be used for the benefit of us.
But what's benefit mean, even then?
Yeah, again, you're picking up on the right words, because I'll talk about the benefit in a way in terms of the Northern Territory in a sec. And two other justices were silent on it. So the actual race power still is quite ambiguous in terms of its legal understanding, as, you know, espoused by the High Court. So there was, you know, still a bit of, you know, having a bet each way, so to speak, in regards to the extent and scope of the race power. And then through the implementation of the Northern Territory Emergency Response, that suite of legislation that came in under Section 5126, that was challenged as well, but it was also found that by implementing legislation said to improve the lot for us fellas, then it could be construed as a benefit. So it certainly, as it stands now, 5126 allows for a very perhaps duplicitous scope of implementing legislation.
And that's what I find so frustrating about the current constitution reform debate, because taking away all the other, you know, the political environment, and just speaking hypothetical, if we had the best political environment to get the best deal for us, I just wonder, because we have such limited public debate about the race power and sort of the constitutional realities behind that, whether we are going to end up going to, if we ever went to a referendum to remove the race power, whether we'd end up with something just as bad or even worse, because we just have such limited understanding, even amongst our own communities, because obviously it's such a really complicated issue, whether we're just going to end up worse off.
Yeah. And I think it's quite right to sort of put those sort of question marks around these issues, because they're damn important. But can I just say that Australia as a whole actually has one of the worst civic awareness percentages in the entire OECD. Mm. And what I mean by civic awareness is about our constitution, about our founding document. You know, so when you've got a large swathe of the population that really doesn't, you know, understand or know about our constitution. And can I just say, I think, you know, from my experiences, us mob actually know a fair bit more about the constitution than mainstream Australia.
I would say that too.
Yes. But nonetheless, when you've got a large proportion of the population that has a very low civic awareness, the challenge really is, you know, hard felt, because you've got to educate people to a basic level of understanding, then take them to that next level of saying, well, you know, if we are to implement something, it needs to be sound. It needs to be legally secure for the protection of not just, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, but all of us in many ways, because that race power is, you know, always was designed for everyone who's not white. And there's legal, you know, history and legal, you know, research that points to exactly that, that they were the origins of Section 15126. The High Court said it countless times, particularly in Katinyuri, was that the very basis of 5126 is laws enacted under that are to be discriminatory by their very nature.
Right, okay.
Now, can I just say as well, like...
Darren, just before you hold that thought.
Sorry, Karen.
We'll just come back to you in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service and on 98.9 FM. We're with Darren Parker, who's a chef-turned-legal academic, and we're talking about some really important issues right now. Don't go away.
You're listening to Let's Talk with myself, Amy McQuire, and my host, Karen Durante, and we're speaking to Ngunnawal legal academic Darren Parker. And Darren, just picking up from where you left, you're just talking about the High Marsh Bridge case.
Yeah, and 5126 in our constitution. Mm. I was just going to ask yourself and Karen and, you know, the listeners out there, what do you guys think the basic rationale for constitutional recognition is?
I think it's just all political, and
I think it's just, well, it's what Abbott wants to be. He wants to be remembered as the, you know, Prime Minister for Indigenous people, the best friend to blackfellas across the country.
Yeah.
So that's me being the cynic.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is the preamble. I think they're always going to be just easy. And I think the fact that they have both knocked back two proposals, one on the non-discrimination provision, but also Noel Pearson, who has a high degree of influence, his position on an Indigenous advisory body to get around that, I think it shows that even if they're not willing to listen to, you know, their favourite Aboriginal leader, I think it points to the fact that we really have, he's not willing to work with Aboriginal people. It's not actually about what blackfellas want or any concrete.
No, it certainly comes through in that regard, because, I mean, let me just say, it's been a complete schmozzle in that regard, because I'm sure you both well recall that initially he said no, there was going to be no Indigenous conventions, and then he said yes just more recently when he met with those Pat, Noel, Kirsty, and Megan down in Canberra just the other week, and then sort of came around and said, okay, you'll have, you know, I think he was worried about getting wedged politically in that regard. And now has more recently, just in the last few days, come out and said, well, I'm going to exclude these. These are, you know, you're aiming too high. This is so-called a log of claims. And it seems to me, you know, and I'm sure it seems to yourselves and many of the listeners, you know, absolutely disingenuous to say, well, okay, you can have your conventions and you can talk about these things, but by the way, these two things, they're completely off the table and we're never going to accept them.
And what's the point of talking about it then?
I think we're tired about, you know, the terms of reference being set by somebody else and not by us.
Exactly, Karen. I couldn't have put it better myself. You know, and I'm sure I'm not, you know, I'm singing to the choir in a great extent, but I've had a gut full of bloody tokenism. I've had an absolute gut full of it. But the reason I was sort of asking you guys about the rationale is because we've got to remember that this is our, you know, this is a constitutional, you know, amendment. A constitution is going to survive throughout the ages. Governments are going to come and go.
Yeah.
You know, they turn around every 3 years, you know, federal governments. But, you know, this constitution is going to be there for, you know, time onward.
Well, I'm sort of the view that we'll only get one crack at it, and so if it's
I hate that view, Amy. I absolutely despise that view. It's like, well, so what? You know, I'm being quite blunt now. If it doesn't happen in my lifetime, great. You know, if it's only going to be a tokenistic gesture and you know it's rejected and it doesn't go through, fine. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I am. You know, I think you know, not be pleased about it in the greater scheme of things, but at the same time, it's a bigger point to say, you know, bugger this tokenism. Look where it's got us so far.
I would agree, except for the fact that, and I think this is sort of a view amongst many people that I've spoken to, is that if you go to a referendum and it is knocked back, you won't get the other issues that Blackfellas have traditionally wanted to talk about on the agenda, because the history of Aboriginal affairs has always been, you know, you look at the push for national land rights, and once that was pretty much off the table, it was basically just pushed away by big miners and Bob Hawke. You've never been anywhere close to national land rights again. So the reason I talk about constitution reform, I mean, this is the only time when it's actually been on the national agenda, and we're looking at a time when it's very, very much focused on meaningless sort of symbolism. And so I feel that even if it goes to a referendum and passes, it's going to be a very long time before you even get close to having this debate again. But I feel it's going to be, you know, treaty, talking about sovereignty, even talking about sovereignty at a national level will never even be close to the agenda.
And can I just also add, the political reality is we're going to need the whole of the Australian community, population, non-Indigenous population on side. And you made this point earlier, Darren, that when it comes to civics and understanding our legal rights and responsibilities or even anything about our founding document, most people are pretty dim on that view. Because they, you know, we're just not educated about it.
No, we're not. We're definitely not. But why I sort of asked you guys that question about what you thought the rationale is, and I take your point, Amy, about, you know, you know, having things out in the open and discussing. But, you know, if we look back to the expert panel's report, you know, and back to the previous Labor government, you know, there was a complete, I think anyway, not a complete, but I'll say a major cognitive dissonance, a complete disconnect in many ways regarding the rationale of improving our lot, improving our health, improving our, you know, mortality rates, improving our, you know, experience with the justice systems, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was, well, we're going to look at, you know, a non-substantive, non-text-based recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in the Constitution. Mm. Now, if it does that, you know, if it goes down that track and it's a, you know, a hollow recognition point, say in the preamble, and I'll talk to you in the preamble in a sec, is that it does nothing towards remedying or fixing the current social indicators that we all sit at the bottom of.
And I think it's interesting you mentioned. Yeah, sorry, keep going.
Sorry, Amy. No. I was just going to say, as it stands, and this is sort of like ironic in many ways, is the way that Section 5126 actually holds true now is that any government, if it had the political will, could implement legislation to combat all of those pathetic and abhorrent social indicators against us, Bob. They could do that. What's lacking is the political will to do so.
Mm. I was just going to raise that exact same point, Darren, because you mentioned also in your piece about the fact, not just about the overtly discriminatory laws in the internet intervention, but the indirectly discriminatory laws. So, for example, in the territory where you've got, you know, really horrendous justice legislation that only compounds the problem. So you've got a matter of, we've seen it, if you look at the territory and the Commonwealth, for example, the Commonwealth can override the territory, but they choose not to do so. So you're exactly right. I mean, that to me shows that there is a complete lack of political will in particularly our most vulnerable places like the Northern Territory.
Yeah, and it's a great point to, you know, really take up the cudgels of, Amy, because, you know, where for all of the political rhetoric and empty speak, and it is empty, of, you know, wanting to sweat blood, wanting to change our lot, you know.
Yep.
And I'll sit aside for a moment the paternalism inherent in many of those sort of statements. But just to bring it back to the Constitution in that regard, is that the Northern Territory, and I know many people are aware of this, the Northern Territory have paperless arrest laws at the moment.
Mm.
Now, whilst they're not a directly discriminatory law, meaning it doesn't say in the actual black and white legislation that it targets Indigenous folk,
it
has an absolute disproportionate effect on the ground, because of all of the historical reasons why we're actually out in public and why, you know, the police are in a greater level of, you know, connection with us, for want of a better term.
There's a lot of visibility, isn't there?
Exactly. So these laws have what is called an indirect, you know, racist effect. Now, if you recall back in 1997 and, you know, the territory implemented euthanasia laws, which the Howard government found repugnant. They didn't like them at all.
Mm.
And what they did was the federal government implemented its own act called the Euthanasia Laws Act of 1997, which contradicted or, you know, conflicted with the Northern Territory laws. Now, through Section 109 of the Constitution, it says that a state or territory law cannot be in conflict with a Commonwealth law.
Yeah.
It was found in conflict. And then also, there's Section 122 of the Constitution, which allows the federal government, actually allows the federal government to implement laws to override territory laws.
Yeah.
So here we have a situation right now, this very day, where these paperless arrest laws are causing harm amongst our communities. It's actually caused a death so far. And yet, our federal government sits on its hands and allows these things to occur. Why aren't they implementing a law that says, right, we're just going to override that because we can't stomach this repugnant, you know, indirect discrimination of Indigenous people? They're not doing it.
Yeah, and I feel that's one of the great the reasons why so many blackfellas are so opposed to constitutional reform is because it is exactly what you raised, is that governments just haven't been willing. Like, they have the ability to legislate and turn around a lot of these discriminatory laws, but they refuse to do so, and we're still in it. And
they're usually
going
willing
backwards
once they're out of parliament.
Yeah,
that's the case, isn't it?
Which is why I think there's so much cynicism around constitutional reform, because it bleeds back to we don't see it in everyday life. I mean, we don't see where the, you know, how it's going to affect us.
No, I totally get that. And to take up Karen's point, that's another infuriating thing that us mob have seen time and time again, is that, you know, you will see, you know, elected officials, public officials who have sat on their hands and in many instances gone against us, then only whilst they're sitting in Parliament or whilst they're sitting in office, I should say, and then once they're out of office, lo and behold, they find their ethics and their heart. And it is infuriating to see that occur time and time again.
I think of an example being the NT Chief Minister Claire Martin, who basically was elected on, you know, playing the race card, and then she was the head of ACOS, or one of the social services agencies. I just thought that was really amazing at the time. She was,
God, was
directly elected. Directly elected for playing the race
card. Was she in power when you had that very public case about the towel and the crayons or chocolate bar being...
I'm not sure.
No, anyway.
I'm trying to think. Yeah.
It was a while ago.
I know
ago,
the
yeah.
one you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Trying to think.
Anyway. Oh. Yeah, no, it is frustrating. I mean, Malcolm Fraser for me is one as well. You know, he was obviously back there in the days of the land rights.
I remember Malcolm, you know. Funnily enough, I studied down at Melbourne University, he was actually a fellow when he was still with us,
mm-hmm.
and had the chance to sort of pass him in the hall and, well, can I just say, let him know what I thought about that. And he was quickly sort of whisked away from me.
Yeah, it wouldn't be fun. I mean, you get all the perks of the high pension and the office and everything like that, but I think there's also coming to grips with the lives that you've affected as Prime Minister. I think there's got to be a lot more accountability, because look at Howard's just running around now giving speeches and has his own office, you know, and look how detrimental he was to our mob. I mean, he was the one who kickstarted this constitutional reform current timeline in modern day. So
I was going to say exactly that, because when we look at the history of it, it actually goes back to the 1930s, if not prior to that. It's us mob seeking constitutional recognition in many ways. But he, Howard certainly was an instigator in that regard. And if you recall, that was pretty much a politically convenient move as well.
Yeah, it was in the 11th hour.
Yeah, at the end of his tenure as Prime Minister, basically, before he got voted out. It was just, as you say, the 11th hour sort of slapped this on and appear to appease, you know, the greatest number for the greatest good, so to speak. But, you know, like I said, you know, consecutive federal governments have done this to us. And, you know, to pick up on your point before, Karen, you know, after you've had it done to you time and time again, I think we, many of us as people, have a right to be bloody cynical about it, you know. But we also have a responsibility to be really aware of what's going on in that regard too.
I was going to just say, Darren, just to move into a more positive thing and get away from the cynicism, is that you're working in circles where, you know, people are interested in addressing these issues and particularly about the high incarceration rates, which have actually worsened since the Royal Commission.
I was actually going to keep it cynical, because, which I think shows the different viewpoints between me and Karen and the way we view the world.
Nice one, Karen.
But I was
all
just
right,
going to say...
Which way do you want me to go? I can do both.
The program, we'll go with Amy and then we'll come back to... We'll finish on a positive note.
I'll
How's that sound?
I'm never positive. But, I was just going to pick up what you're talking about, public awareness and the cynicism. I think I don't know how you feel about the Recognise campaign, but I think... I was reading in The Australian a couple of days ago, and it was a piece based on some of the comments. They spoke to an elder from Mur, and he really made me realise just how little black fellas all around the country know about, because, I mean, us in the media, we've been talking about it like for the past 5 years.
Mm.
But he's talking about the fact, oh, it could be a good thing, but, you know, no one really here knows much about it. You know?
And we'll just let all the urban... fellas talk about it, you know.
Yeah, all the money that's gone into it, you know, the millions of dollars that have gone into the Recognise campaign, and we're still having really, like, shallow debates and there's very little awareness around
it. And we're seeing
it.
Things like R being painted onto the lines of football fields, for crying
yeah,
out
just,
loud.
When yeah. you talk to you, Darren, I mean, there's so many complexities and even there's, you know, potential implications for even just considering removing the race power. So it's not just a simplistic thing we're debating and yet no one has an idea about what we're even debating.
No. And that's, you're so on point to, you know, bring this sort of up because it just becomes infuriating where, you know, mob, particularly in rural and remote areas, have little or no interaction with, as you say, you know, the major cities and the urban movement of recognition. Now, you know, to take up what the example Karen just said about, like, recognise and, you know, football, you know, I've seen, you know, countless professional footballers come through and stand there with the, you know, the R shirt on and whatnot. But really, when it comes to it, I don't think I want to be advised constitutionally by a professional football player.
No.
Exactly.
You know, I certainly don't think, I'm not saying this should be a lawyer's fest, but then again, who the bloody hell knows constitutional law and public law better than lawyers and academics? So you're going to have, you know, lawyers and academics there because I don't want footballers, I don't want second-rate novelists, I don't want, you know, non-experts sitting in there going, oh, well, we'll just slap this in. How about that? Because you can't simply, and this is to take that point you made before, Amy, is you can't simply just remove Section 5126 because it actually holds a number of important pieces of legislation to our benefit, such as the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act. You know, whilst it may be weak, it's still there in many ways to protect our cultural heritage. If you remove Section 5126 in that regard, that legal hook, so to speak, is also removed, and the legislation that's passed under it falls away because you need to have a legislative hook in the Constitution for federal laws to be passed.
And I wonder how many TOs actually know that.
It needs to be put out there. And that's a failing of the Recognise campaign in many ways, is if they're not doing that, and, you know, from talking to many mob and actually been to a number of their community functions, I haven't seen them do that. I've seen them talking about removing, you know, the racist elements from the Constitution and very little else, you know. And again, it's a bit of an indictment on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of motherhood statements and I feel
it's become an advertising slogan, basically, slogfest, hasn't it?
And I think it's very directed towards white Australia, just the way it's been promoted.
It is. And the reason that is, I can only surmise, is that, you know, for a referendum to pass, according to Section 128 of the Constitution, it requires what we call a double majority. So we need a majority of voters in a majority of states. Now, just for mob who may be in the Territory or in the ACT, can I just tell you don't count in the second part of that equation.
Yeah, you only get half a vote, do you, in effect?
Their votes in the ACT and the Territory only go towards that first hurdle, the majority of voters.
Right.
That's about it. So you need this double hurdle. So you need a majority of voters of more than 50%, and then you need a majority of states. So you need four.
It'd be interesting to see. I mean, so Abbott has agreed to, you know, pay for these conferences for people to go around and talk about these issues, you know. Whether there will be this, you know, movement with people saying, well, actually, no, we've heard the stuff that, Darren, you've been talking about today. And no, we don't want it.
But will Abbott listen? That's the thing.
Yeah, it's true.
Can I just say as well, like, and this is a really important point to make to mob everywhere, that you can't just attend our conventions. You need to attend our conventions and those mainstream conventions. And the reason why is because Abbott and the government have implemented, you know, it was one of the, you know, bargaining tools, and it was why I said before that I thought it was a political, you know, a cynically political move, when he allowed for, sorry, I was doing those, you know, air quotes, allowed for Indigenous conventions, he traded it off and said, okay, if I give you that, then we'll implement a referendum council that sits over the top. What that referendum council will do is listen to both conventions and see what comes out of it, and then decide and put to the government, here's the referendum question you should ask the Australian people.
So it's ultimately,
so
and
Bob,
I think,
actually need to go to both ours and theirs, because otherwise, and this goes into what I was saying about that double majority, otherwise we've got two separate levels. We've got mob conventions talking at a higher level in many ways, going about, you know, racial discrimination, parliamentary bodies, and then we've got, you know, the mainstream level sitting, you know, at a much, much lower rung, talking about, oh, well, it would be really nice if we recognise all of these black people.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. That's been the whole trajectory of the debate at the moment. It's been very much geared towards that. So I don't see it changing. And I just, the joint parliamentary report that spent a very long time actually talking again to, you know, people involved in the constitutional reform movement, and they came away with three recommendations, or three alternatives to for a referendum question. And none of them were even debated. None of them were responded to. And in fact, this was something Noel Pearson said, was that Ken Wyatt has actually just knocked back his own recommendations of the report.
That was amazing to me. Was, you know, you make a recommendation in, you know, a joint parliamentary report, and then 2 weeks later you turn away and go, actually.
I mean, what's the point?
You know, support that.
Dan, Darren's going to need a Bex and a lie down after this discussion.
I don't at all. I love this stuff, Karen. I thrive on it.
I was just thinking we should get you on and just get people to ring up and ask you questions, because I think it is, you're right. There's just the implications. There's been no public debate around it, and it's sad that we're having it so late, where we're actually trying to have these sort of consultations as well. But I was just wondering, Darren, if you look at taking away, you know, the political environment currently, if we were able to put in, you know, have a good debate and put in the right recommendation or the right question to a referendum, do you see it? And a lot of your piece was focused around justice and reducing the numbers of blackfellas locked up around the country. Do you think changing the constitution, starting to decolonise those superstructures, would actually have that flow-on effect? I mean, is that the way we go, or we should just keep pushing governments to implement, like, justice policies or justice reinvestment plans? Is it the right way to go to just look at the constitution?
I don't like to play binaries in these sort of things. I think we're, you know, big enough, and we've been here long enough, and we're definitely smart enough to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So I think we should actually be doing both. It's a multi-prong attack. And by that I mean, like, we definitely need, I'll just pick one instance. We definitely need a non-discrimination clause in the Constitution.
Yeah.
And that's something that benefits all Australians, can I just say. You know, it's not just something that's totally focused on us mob, but I'm not trying to generalise this here, but just the reality of it is, if you're not a white male, you're pretty much othered in this country, and you're othered pretty, pretty substantially in many ways.
Mm.
But a non-discrimination clause works for all of us. If we then, you know, be more focused in terms of us mob, is it can then, from working from that, it can then be that wedge where you push and you poke state and territory governments at COAG level and say, right, because of this non-discrimination clause, we're going to now implement all of these justice targets where we're seeing direct and indirect discriminatory laws that, you know, have this knock-on effect on the ground for our people, and make the state and territory law premiers and administrators implement these justice targets, which then in turn gives our mob at community and local levels the power to actually work through these instances on the ground. And, you know, if we look at, you know, justice reinvestment programs that are only just sort of in the infancy stage in this country, they're already having positive effects in, you know, lowering recidivism, and also just keeping mob out of, I'll take another instance in regards to the criminal justice system, taking them out of the contact with those gatekeepers of it, the police.
Yeah, that's very true.
So I think it has that, you know, that's why I don't play those two off against each other. I think, now, bugger that, we can do both. We've been here long enough. We know enough about this. Hell's sake, we've been experiencing it for, you know, donkey's years. We can do both, and we should demand that. And that's not setting the bar too high. That's not, you know, seeking a log of claims.
No.
That's just being bloody realistic about the fact that we're dying at an incredibly lower rate. We're being locked up at an amazingly abhorrent higher rate, as Karen said. It's actually increased since the Royal Commission into deaths in custody. You know, these are the realities that can and must be fixed.
Yeah, I think there's such an urgency. It's the next generation, really. And then you look at the, you know, the flow-on effects locking up so many black fellas and Aboriginal kids have on child protection systems, and just the way they rip families apart, and how it just continues the trauma that we've felt since invasion.
And they
talk
about
an urgent problem we have to deal with now.
Talk about it being another stolen generation, you know, kids growing up without their fathers. And, I mean, the lock-up rate for Indigenous women is also increasing.
Yep. Continually to go
up. All across the board, Sam. Mm. And it breaks my heart to say it. It's all across the board that those rates are actually increasing. You know, where we've got, like, you know, as you said, Karen, you know, another stolen generation which has gone through, you know, the process of removing children from their families due to family violence, or, you know, for the most part, a number of, you know, reasons that points towards family violence. That's something we need to, you know, combat, and combat as soon as we can, because they just can't keep going like this, you know.
I just wonder whether, Darren, the politicians have seen that there's that pie graph that you have in your article where it shows here's the representation of Indigenous people in prison, and here's the representation of Indigenous people who've actually attended university or finished the year 12. And
My God, that's shocking, that, isn't it? It's absolutely shocking. And, you know, one of the things about, you know, those type of graphs is they're just a very instant visual realisation of how putrid the situation is in many ways.
Right. Well, I think on that note, Darren, we have to leave it there. I was going to hope that we finish on something positive.
All right.
But we can't, because we've got 30 seconds, then we've got to go to the news.
Say something positive quickly.
All right. Get involved, and we can change things.
That's great. Thanks so much for your time today, Darren. We'll definitely have to get you on again.
Love to. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Karen.
We've got that on record now, so, Darren, you can't back down. Good on you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Amy. It's been great presenting Let's Talk with you the last few days. Tiger's back in the chair. Tomorrow.
Yeah, so and I think we've got Noel Pearson tomorrow.